Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
This is Richard Martin here for the hour with Richard Martin's wake-up call, coming to you from a very windswept Miami after the hurricane sideswiped it and did its damage elsewhere in the States. First of all, before I move ahead, I want to remind you about tonight's showing of the IOUSA movie, which, as you probably know, is only showing once. It is showing today, this evening, in various different parts of the country. I've mentioned this before. I think you should all see the movie. And if you have a chance to go tonight, you can get your tickets online. As far as I know, you can do this by going to agorafinancial.com/IOUSA. Now, I'm going to repeat that, so don't panic. Get your pens at the ready. I think probably www. And then the word is Agora Financial, all one word. That's AGORAFINANCIAL. agorafinancial.com/IOUSA. That's an amalgam of IOU and USA. IOUSA. It has interviews with luminaries such as Warren Buffett. It has David Walker, the ex-comptroller of the currency, who will spill his beans. It should be a very interesting movie. I shall go myself. And so hopefully we'll have some interesting discussions from those of you on Monday who have seen the movie. I will urge you to pick up the phone and call us, and perhaps we can, jimmy up a discussion between three or four people. We have several lines, so many people can call in at the same time, and see what you all think. Once more, the website to get your tickets for this movie and to get other information, of course, also about the movie is agorafinancial.com/IOUSA. I think it's 8 o'clock everywhere. I know it is in our local cinema. And there's just one showing, only one showing today. No other showings have been planned anywhere. The idea is if it does well enough, they will hope to attract somebody to distribute it, and then they will have, of course, general distribution. But it's pretty out there, I understand, and so not at all sure that any distributor will want to pick it up. They clearly haven't so far, but it's right along our avenue of thought and discussion, so it should be interesting. Okay. Let's look at what's really happening with the banking system here. We've talked about it before, but the generalized collapse that I've been warning about is sort of gathering more and more steam. A year ago, it was already obvious that the U.S. could not sustain its present position as the consumer of all global resources and manufacturing. The dislocations Americans are suffering today are part of this collapse in the U.S.'s ability to be the top global consumers. As you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are at the brink of collapse as we speak. The government in Japan is also about to collapse due to their extremely cruel methods of killing inflation, which we don't really see here, by destroying working wages and allowing global inflation to rage out of control at home. Pretty generally, I think you could say investors have been totally abusing the liquidity that has been made available courtesy of the central banks. They have not been using it to build factories and to improve infrastructure. They've used it to build inappropriate housing, much of which needs lots of gasoline for commuting to work. The number one industry in the United States was to build housing, and the number two industry was to finance it, as well as business takeovers. Well, our dynamic part of this nation's economy is to churn money and generate increasing levels of debt. Well, I'll tell you, the debt load has a limit, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, we reached this with the housing business, since the proportion of people taking non-traditional loans went from less than 3% to more than 45% in less than 7 years. Home buyers no longer had the income or the status to qualify for traditional loans, which were set in place after the Great Depression. I mean, it's pretty amazing to me to watch everyone, and I mean everyone, celebrating this obvious capitulation of the Federal Reserve to the present system. Well, this is the essential and most important aspect of the evolving global banking breakdown, namely dealing with the business of the U.S. importing far, far too much and spending far, far too much on global imperial domination. Until this is fixed, the international banking and trading systems will continue to destroy themselves. No one can revert to the pre-destructive system, or they will be destroyed by a flood of free, funny money that is still trying to pour out of the U.S. and Japanese banking systems. The central bankers of both Japan and the U.S. are trying to solve this imbalanced system by dropping interest rates. Yet, obviously, both are the ultimate cause of global inflation. Well, the global banking system is desperate to be recapitalized. But they can't do this at interest rates of 0.5% or 2%. You know, since the two entities trying this scheme are the world's top two economies, this dooms all other efforts to correct this mess by raising interest rates to attract savings. Instead, as Europe and China discovered, this attracts fake money churned out by the US and Japan, and it ends up causing huge inflation surges and a collapse of one's ability to trade. So we are now seeing a global push to drop interest rates and destroy currency relative values, which is really a kind of spiral into nothingness. Well, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I'm sure you've heard that they are now really at death's door, and they need to repay $223 billion worth of bond by the end of the quarter, and their success in doing this will, in fact, determine whether they can avoid a federal bailout or not. Fannie Mae, which is based in Washington, has about $120 billion of debt maturing through September the 30th, while Freddie Mac, which is based in Virginia, has $103 billion. Those are figures provided by the government chartered companies and data compiled by Bloomberg. Rising borrowing costs and evidence that demand for their debt was waning last month led Treasury Secretary Paulson to seek the authority to pump unlimited amounts of capital in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in an emergency. Their interest costs are again increasing amid concern that credit losses are depleting the capital of these two beleaguered companies. You know, directors and controllers are supposed to direct and control. A system of barriers had been set up, you know, hedges and systems designed to prevent wild lending leading to a Great Depression. All of these were overturned or burnt to the ground so the system could run riot. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were emergency systems set up temporarily to fund lower-class housing during the Great Depression. After World War II, the government expanded these systems to house the GIs who were busy fathering the baby boom generation. Since the U.S. then was definitely the most powerful manufacturing giant in the world, this was obviously okay, since the working classes now had things called jobs. And this made export stuff as well as things the Americans and others consumed at home. There was a point where Japan began to outstrip the United States. It started very small. The U.S. was boasting about its space program, its nuclear bomb program, its big car business. And Japan came out with the very first transistor radios, which were actually notable for their bright colors. Some of you may remember them. Certainly everyone in the U.K. was buying these things. Sony itself was created due to the U.S. manufacturers clinging to their big systems and refusing to manufacture transistor radios at all. You know, the U.S. has gone down this road because of the need to make big, expensive things due to labor costs here. The Japanese dealt with all this easily. They cheerfully crushed their own workers no matter what. The U.S., on the other hand, had to compete with communism, and so it had to allow unions and improving workers' living conditions, which in turn created the golden age of unionism, but it also doomed its manufacturing systems. And as we see with General Motors and Chrysler, the system is sort of like the old Soviet Union's manufacturing, big, obese, poorly engineered manufacturing that is mostly sold internally. Now, the U.S. needs desperately to recapitalize its entire systems. As we saw in a stupid story yesterday in CNN about thrifty rich kids deep in debt, thinking they can retire at 40, the economics writers and representatives, as well as the top 2% of this nation, seriously think that wealth is debt. Well, I've warned people, you know, when you use leverage to get rich and a downturn happens, everybody doing this gets crushed to death by economic forces. And that's exactly what's happening with this nation right now. Its debts are not assets. They are destructive, like cancer. And I had a hard time years ago telling people this, trying to make people understand that wealth is not debt. You may think that you own a beautiful house, but if it's, you know, 95% financed, you don't have wealth. You have debts. Not at all the same thing. Okay, all right, now, let me give you my information very quickly. The name is Richard Martin. The program is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, coming to you live from Florida through the studios in New York City. Our call-in number, which I urge you to use to call in questions, comments, rants, whatever it is that's on your mind, call our toll-free number at 888-873-4643. Let me repeat that once more. It is 888-873-4643. Just call. You'll talk to our engineer, Ryan, who will put you on hold. He will inform me on the computer, and I will take your call just as soon as we have a break in the proceedings. Okay? So please call. We'd really like to hear from you, 888-873-4643. If you'd like to write in your questions, as most people seem to do, by email, you can do that by writing to the following address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. Repeat that once more, the word corporation, please, to be written out in full, the GS standing for Global Strategic. Global Strategic Investments is the company where I work and bring home bacon from in Miami. And once more, the address is rmartin@gscorporation.com. And finally, my private direct line phone number for all of you who would like to ask me personal questions about your assets and deployment of same. You should call me, please, at the following number, area code 305-357-5575. Once more, 305-357-5575. 305-357-5575. Okay. Now, we've got quite a lot of mail here. Just before we go into that, I thought that I would let you know. I'm sure most of you who live in the New York area are aware that Governor David Paterson on Tuesday gave a dire outlook on the state's economy, saying that the Wall Street bonuses would be slashed by 30 or 40% this year. Tax revenues on capital gains could also fall much more than he previously estimated. Paterson said that the state may be facing its worst hardship since the Great Depression. He said economists he had consulted told him that tax revenues on capital gains could fall as much as 35%. He said his previous forecasts for a 10 to 20% drop in Wall Street bonuses and a 16 to 24% fall in capital gains tax revenues were likely to be wrong. New York's banks and brokerages generate one out of every five tax dollars in the state. Bonuses comprise a large portion of the income earned by many Wall Streeters. And the bonuses which have fallen with Wall Street's profits and capital gains, which have been hurt by the steep decline in stock prices, are critical drivers of state revenues. Paterson stressed how he is assessing the economic outlook, which the Assembly Democrats have said is not as dire. And I quote, "But sometimes you have to feel it, like in Star Wars when Luke flies a plane. Well, the plane is telling me that it's going to get much worse," he said. Well, legislators have not officially agreed to any budget cuts, according to Paterson, but a source familiar with the talks said there was a preliminary agreement to slash $400 million, but added no bills had been drafted, and the source requested anonymity. The governor, who took office in mid-March, has already pruned $630 million from the current budget and wants the legislature to slice another $600 million. The state's budget totals around $121 billion, and the shortfalls over the next 3 years top $26 billion. Paterson said there were opportunities to raise some taxes, including getting Indian reservation stores to pay cigarette taxes. "There are a certain number of taxes that we could raise in certain areas, but that tax on the Indians would require some litigation and some real negotiation, which I'd be meaning to do anyway," he said. Well, and I assure you that what you hear in New York and what I told you about happening in California is being repeated everywhere, all over the country, to a greater or lesser extent. Okay. All right, so let's take a couple of emails that have come in right now. They came in a few moments ago, so I'm going to read them off the computer. I usually print them out and store them away, but wasn't able to do it with these ones, so here goes. The first one comes from Ray Dorman of Arlington, Virginia, who says, "Richard, without sounding like I'm beating a dead horse, I'd like to revisit the topic of inflation versus deflation you've talked about many times. I believe the crux of the issue and the reason most people are generally confused about this topic is as follows. Many of us, myself included, have been led to believe that since the departure from the gold standard, the US dollar has been consistently hijacked by central bankers. We've been living with a steady rate of inflation year after year. This has debased the currency and effectively acted as a hidden tax on those who choose to use the dollar. If this is true, then we are not currently seeing a contraction from an already inflated currency. Isn't the downturn we're feeling really just a backlash effect from previous inflationary policy? If so, then one could argue that we are feeling the effects of inflation, or at least the effect of a flawed, long-standing inflationary practice. On a related note, what is or will be in the future, will in the future stop those with the virtual printing presses from simply creating more money in order to bail the U.S. out of our growing debt? How does our situation compare to that with other nations throughout history which have experienced hyperinflation? There was a time in Argentina where people would literally cash their paychecks and run to the store to buy whatever they could get their hands on. The motivation was to avoid the rapidly increasing prices on goods, which were rising at such a rate, simply to keep pace with the devaluation of the currency. Please let me know if I'm totally out of touch here. Thanks, sincerely, Ray Dorman. Ray, my thinking on the issue of printing money is that this country is exceptional in the world as relates to countries like Argentina and also to Zimbabwe. In the country's currency here is the world's reserve currency. Now, this has very serious implications. If this is the world's reserve currency, it means that unlike in Argentina or Zimbabwe, where foreigners probably only hold enough currency to for their immediate needs, this country contains a currency which is used by people in other countries to invest their excess cash. Now, if you are investing your excess cash, you are basically in a situation where you can sell that currency at any time and repatriate the funds into your own currency. This paradoxically makes the United States very vulnerable to countries like China, with over $1 trillion worth of currency invested in the United States, deciding that if the United States is going to print money like it's going out of fashion, they don't want anything to do with it, and they could just as easily sell their currency and buy, let's say, euros or yen or another currency or a mixture of currencies to replace their investments in the States. Now, the Americans cannot risk that happening. It would literally decimate their economy and create an untenable situation politically and socially, and they simply would not allow it to happen. So, I think from the point of view of the printing presses, Bernanke may have threatened to use them, but he won't. I mean, it's as simple as that. He simply will not. On your other issue, Ray, of deflation, remember that the old adage of what goes up must come down is as true of inflation as it is of anything else. In other words, if you have a given lengthy period of inflation that in the case of the United States has succeeded in pricing the country out of the competition in terms of manufacturing, there must be an unwinding process. And notice I'm saying unwinding. We're not taking a situation of no inflation and creating deflation from it. We are taking an outpriced situation of inflation where people are priced out of the market, as we've seen, not only in manufacturing, but also in housing. Now you have houses that no first-time home buyer could ever dream of buying because they're too expensive. Ray, the unwinding process from this inflation is the horror that we are all going to have to live with for the next 10 years or whatever it is. You know, a contraction from a currency is very often just described as a devaluation of the currency, which is kind of difficult and makes sometimes will make exports advantageous if your currency is cheapening in relation to other countries. But it can also work the other way, that if your currency is going up in value, then exports are harder to carry out, and of course imports come in at a greater pace if the other foreign currencies are cheaper. But real, honest deflation is an animal that you don't want to see. It involves the wholesale liquidation of currency through defaults, bankruptcies, foreclosures, and the like, where basically your money simply becomes more valuable by virtue of the fact that everything that's quoted against it is falling in value, where it had been rising in value in a previous inflationary wave. It is now falling in value as the inflation gives way to deflation. So therefore, that is what I believe is happening right now, Ray, and I don't think that we're feeling the effects of inflation. I think we're feeling the effects of past inflation. And I think it's hard for people to grasp that. I think it's hard for people to believe that things could get worse if prices go down. And that explains why the government seems to spend so much time trying to keep prices levitated, whether it's prices, you know, of the stock market or of the housing market or commodities. Crazy though it may seem, people try to keep prices high. And I've never understood what they think they can gain by that. But, of course, if you have a mortgage and your house price comes down in value and you're now financing something which is not there anymore, namely a high price you paid for a home which is now, let's say, 50% cheaper in value than when you bought it, then clearly there's a problem. And so it's unfortunate, but the very fact of prices coming down creates the deflation that we're all going to need to see in order to bring the economy back on keel sometime down the line in however many years it's going to take and how many economic lives it's going to ruin. It's very sad, but I'm afraid that's really what we have to look forward to. Okay. I get an email right around the same time from Kevin Sierra, who says, "Richard, quick note on buying American Eagles from the U.S. Mint. Individuals cannot buy the bullion versions of the Eagles directly from the Mint." Correct. "The bullion versions must be bought through a dealer. It has been this way since the program began years ago. Individuals can buy the collectible versions of these coins, proof and uncirculated, through the Mint. These sets sell for a premium over the normal bullion versions. Both the proof and uncirculated versions of the 1 ounce coin are selling for about $1,200. Thank you very much for that information. Very well worthwhile knowing about that. You are absolutely correct. You have to go through a dealer. Unlike when you want to buy treasury bills, you can go directly to the government through treasurydirect.net or .com. I don't remember which it is. All right. Once again, my call-in number is 888-873-4643. All right, so let's go straight to Steve Kruger's rant. Thank you very much. I was wondering where it was, Steve, and sure enough, at 2:26 p.m., i.e. 1 minute ago, it pops up on my computer. So here we go. Richard, while watching C. Martinson's Crash Course, one thing hit me that I have heard before is that the 6 billion people in the world is too many people. We have the wealthy elitists going public saying that we should have a world population of between 1 and 2 billion people. These are folks like Bill Gates, Ted Turner, and even the late Jacques Cousteau are quoted as saying to reduce the population. The only thing they disagree with is the timetable. Some say 80 to 100 years, others like Cousteau want it much quicker. I first got wind of this in 1992, and if we end a worldwide depression and have given up a lot of our freedom, you can expect anything. Richard, this doesn't have much to do with the economy today. It is something to be aware of down the road. If times get hard enough, the elitists and social engineers might find a way to put this into effect. I hope I don't sound like I see a conspirator under every rock, but things were not all that rosy in 1936 Germany either." Steve Kruger. No, they weren't, Steve. You're absolutely right. And unfortunately, one of the little discussed and little known facets of war is that the purpose of war is to reduce population. It is to find oneself in a situation where there is such a preponderance of people that we need to see a reduction of people in our society, and war takes care of that need. You will not hear that expressed anywhere, but I assure you that is what happens when there is an overabundance of people in any given area of the world. It is very frightening, and again, I don't do politics, so I'm not going to dwell on this, but when you look at the amount of different hotspots in the world from which a major conflict could erupt at any time, it is truly terrifying. And yet, theoretically and logically, if there are indeed too many people in the world, the only real way in which they can be reduced is either through war or through some form of pandemic which is also a systematic and cyclical function of societies and economies, and has been since time immemorial. So we have that to look forward to too. But basically, you're on the right track, I think, there, Steve, and I appreciate the ability, the opportunity to discuss it. All right. I've talked a lot about central bankers, ladies and gentlemen, and I thought I'd just talk a little bit more about why they really are the enemy of the system, in both good times and bad. There is no redeeming feature to central banks. Why it should be that central banks think they have the authority to decide on interest rates in an economy, as opposed to business in general and banks, just regular banks in general, I will never understand. It is a form of centralized government, which is quite anathema to a free society, and I am most surprised, actually, that the Federal Reserve has lasted as long as it has, and I don't see it lasting much longer. And as time goes by, if I'm still doing the Richard Martin wake-up call, I am quite certain that my opinions will gather credibility. Those opinions also belong to Ron Paul, and the sad part about it is, of course, that Ron Paul will not have an opportunity to put his thoughts and ideas into practice. But, you know, as things are right now, central bankers really are what you might call the keepers of the keys to the kingdom. The problem with our kingdom here in the United States is that it's on the edge of bankruptcy and in danger, as frankly, never before. Comparisons are being made to the Great Depression of the 1930s, but really, the comparisons are nothing more than just that. In some ways, I think the situation is similar, but in many ways it isn't. But in a very fundamental way, the conditions are much worse. The systemic strains on the global financial systems are today much more profound than even during the Great Depression. The Great Depression of the 1930s was unique in the history of capital markets, built on debt-based money, or capitalism. Until the creation of the Federal Reserve System in 1913, the U.S. economy had been a savings-based, not a debt-based economy. And the difference between those two is actually very rarely understood, but it is profound. You know, the price paid for credit-based expansion is debt. If you increase the debt-based money supply, you increase the amount of debt. That is quite clear and obvious, because every penny that comes into the system through the creation of money comes in as debt. Okay? So over the naturally limited life of a debt-based economy, the constantly increasing and compounding levels of debt will grow and grow until finally the economy collapses. So compounding debt, which is obviously the wellspring of bankers' profits, will eventually destroy the economy on which it lives. The time it takes to do so is dependent on the strength and productivity of the underlying economy. No economy at all, no matter how strong initially, can outrun the constantly compounding debt of credit-based money, not even the United States. Now, it's important to understand this, because if you understand that the purpose of the Federal Reserve is to create more debt, i.e. more money in the system, what do you think happens to a central bank like the Federal Reserve when the whole operation goes the other way? Namely, money is sucked out of the system through bankruptcies, credit is not extended anymore by the banks because they don't want to lend to people with no assets and no ability to repay. What is the utility of the Federal Reserve in those circumstances? Well, the answer, you know, is zero. And so, frankly, the Federal Reserve talks itself out of a job. And eventually, In my opinion, the Federal Reserve will be disbanded through a complete lack of credibility. And then we will have, fortunately, another lengthy period without a central bank where inflation is at a minimum and the banks decide for themselves how much credit to issue based on a simple competitive economy of banking where banks compete for money, and that is in itself what keeps the level of interest down throughout the economy. Let's talk to Steve from Newark in New Jersey, who's on the line. Hi there, Steve.
Hey, how's it going? I have a question about kind of like your worldly background. When times are tough, you have to rely on your family. And I recently had a meal with a Filipino family, and there was no anxiety and no tension. And I told my friend about this on the way home, and he turned to me and he said, only Americans hate their families. And I was wondering if that's true. You've lived all over the world. It's hard to go back here in America because there's so much dysfunction. And if you don't have any real assets, you're kind of on your own. I was just wondering if you found that different in other places you've lived.
It's very different. Very, very different indeed, Steve. In fact, so different that it's embarrassing. I mean, you know, if you just cross over the border into Mexico and you see for yourself, spend any time in Mexico, preferably with the ability to speak Spanish and understand what's going on there, you'll be absolutely bowled over by the degree to which Mexicans set store by their families and the importance that they give to families. I mean, systematically, old people live with young people in a family. The grandparents live with the kids. The family unit is second to none in Latin America, and it makes for a very caring and a very loving environment, which is absolutely unknown in the United States. I do think it used to be like that. My understanding is that in the old days, people were much more concerned with their families. Frankly, I think it was in the days before mass travel allowed people, you know, to live hundreds of miles away from their families and to move around for a very low cost and set up shop, you know, just about anywhere. Those were the days when I think that Americans were more caring and more mindful of the social aspects of the economy and the economic devastation that is about to hit here. Today, I think you have a situation where Americans simply are not mindful at all of their families. I think Americans would agree with me. I don't think there's a dispute about this. But certainly in Asia, it's like in Latin America. To a degree, it's like that in Europe. See, Europe is much smaller than the United States, so it's much more difficult to actually get away from your family. You know, you live in Paris, and you've got family in Lyon, or family in, let's say Strasbourg or Nice. You're very, very close to your family. You do go there for a weekend. It's not a problem. So, you know, it's a much more sort of family friendly environment in Europe. Curiously enough, living in Miami as I have for the last 10 years, I am struck by the degree to which people here have sort of cut themselves off entirely from their families, or their families have cut themselves off from the older retirees here. But of course, push comes to shove when people get old here, because when you're old, really old, in southern Florida, and you really can't look after yourself, as often as not, you have to go back up north to live near your children. Or the alternative, of course, is to go to the nursing homes here. But people don't realize it's another thing that happens. People say, oh, people are always going to come and live in South Florida. They're always going to come here. Well, actually, right now, there is a net exodus of people from Florida, not necessarily through old age, but through a disillusionment with, you know, what life is actually like here. So I think that one of the things that the coming downturn will bring home to people is the importance of family and the degree to which, you know, family is really an integral part of how one lives as a human being, and not just economically, although, of course, economically, when, you know, families who are thrown out of their homes in foreclosure have nowhere to go, as often as not, I guess they'll just go back and live with mum and pop until, you know, times improve. But I think that that's something you'll see here. You'll see a huge change in attitudes and, you know, family relationships.
Did you find that in England? You were pushed out the door?
England is the apotheosis of smallness, isn't it? I mean, did you know that if you're in the British Isles, you are never more than 55 miles away from the coast? You cannot get any further away than 55 miles, meaning that, you know, families are really at close proximity with their offspring, you know, and there's no getting away from it. So it is a little bit different there. The problem in the United States really is one of distance. I mean, you know, most people that I meet down here in Florida have come from some far-flung part of the country. Very few people seem to come from actually Florida itself. And I found the same thing was true when I lived in Los Angeles. People had come from all over the place. It doesn't really happen in the United Kingdom because the country's just too small. You know, since I've lived there, they've got many more freeways and things. And I mean, it takes no time to go anywhere in the United Kingdom. So I don't think you have that problem there. You know, this is something that Americans are going to have to deal with as time goes by and as money becomes scarce and as assets, you know, simply just not available to people to indulge the luxury of just ignoring one's family and going it alone. That's the way I think I'm going to see it in times in the future, Steve.
Okay.
Thank you for your question. That was very useful, very interesting. Okay, let's a little bit more about what happened with the Federal Reserve after it was created in 1913. I think it's important to know because the Fed is really behind the troubles we face today. Not the government, not Congress, not the president. It is not more than just a truism to say that the chairman of the Federal Reserve is probably the most powerful man in the world, which is why I go on and on like I do about Greenspan, ladies and gentlemen, because it is essential for you to know why Greenspan messed up, what he did that was so egregious, and why he did it, in as much as we can ever know these things, why he did it, you know, infused and imbued as he was with the idea that he was such an important man and that he must be popular, he must be liked at all costs. You know, modern economics is a shell game, a 300-year-old confidence game designed to hide the fact that bankers' credit replaced real money, credit created out of thin air by private bankers and public government that leaves compounding debt and ultimately economic destruction in its wake. Recently, because of the increasing collusion between bankers and government, the line between private banking and public government is gone. They are now virtually one and the same. Only the union hasn't been publicly announced because of anticipated opposition to the now consummated marriage. Central bankers are modern-day competence men who have so embedded themselves into the fabric of everyday commerce that people are convinced they need credit in order to survive. Sort of like Elvis Presley in his final days believing he needed prescription pills to live. And to continue the analogy, just as Dr. Nick, Elvis Presley's pill doctor, is responsible for killing Elvis with his overprescription of drugs, Dr. Bernanke, the current U.S. credit doctor, and his predecessor, Dr. Greenspan, will be remembered for their fatal overprescribing of central bank credit to the U.S. and world economy. Well, it's the same thing. Too much of a good thing is and always has been, in the end, a bad thing. Well, you know, Americans are often telling themselves that safeguards are in place that will prevent another Great Depression. And as we are now on the edge of another such collapse, it would do us well to take another look at those safeguards to see how safe we actually are or aren't. The daisy chain of debt defaults set in motion by the collapse of the 1920s bubble caused 15,000 banks to fail between 1929 and 1933. So in 1933, the government responded by passing the Glass-Steagall Act to prevent another such collapse. Unfortunately, you see, the Glass-Steagall Act was designed to deal not with the cause, i.e. debt-based Federal Reserve banknotes fueling excessive speculation, but with the results, in other words, bank failures and loss of savings. Nonetheless, the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 was the reassurance Americans believed would ensure it won't happen again. Now, Glass-Steagall prohibited investment banks from again acting as commercial banks. No longer could investment banks, which make speculative bets, own commercial banks, which accepted savings deposits from customers and thereby risked the savings of depositors. But in 1999, Glass-Steagall was repealed. On November 12, 1999, President Bill Clinton signed into law the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which repealed the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. One of the effects of the repeal was to allow commercial and investment banks to consolidate. Some economists, of course, have criticized the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act as contributing to the 2007 subprime mortgage financial crisis. One reason banks are losing money is the repeal 9 years ago of the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial and investment banking after excessive risk-taking contributed to the Great Depression. The repeal enabled commercial lenders such as Citigroup, the largest U.S. bank by assets, to underwrite and trade instruments such as mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations and establish so-called structured investment vehicles, or SIVs, that bought those securities. And guess what? Citigroup played a major part in the repeal. The then-called Citicorp company merged with Travelers Insurance Company the year before, utilizing loopholes in Glass-Steagall that allowed for temporary exemptions. Look at J.P. Morgan, brought in to bail out Bear Stearns. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's all very well if you're Bear Stearns, but if you're a depositor of money in J.P. Morgan, if you put your hard-earned cash in J.P. Morgan, and now they're fooling around, you know, with a broker, basically, you know, a casino operator, do you really think that should be allowed? Because I assure you, before 1999, it couldn't have happened. But there you go. I mean, the situation, the economic situation is so crazy. It's so mindless. That they could do this. I mean, they just the bankers just put pressure on Congress and basically repealed an act which was designed to protect people and had protected people more or less with impunity since 1933. I mean, look, this is what happened in 1999. Investment banks, insurance companies, and real estate companies together gave $200 million. To U.S. politicians in order to repeal the act specifically designed to prevent another Great Depression. And now the idea that investment bankers such as U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, fresh from Goldman Sachs, will save America's economy is absurd. Paulson and his cohorts are not in Washington, D.C. to save America. They're there to profit and save themselves. Well, the $200 million lobbying effort by investment bankers, real estate and insurance companies to repeal Glass-Steagall prevailed, but their task is not yet over. Investment bankers via the privately owned Federal Reserve System are now about to complete their control over the entire U.S. financial system. Well, there's a lot more to talk about. The Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which repealed Glass-Steagall, and by the way, you know, Graham was Phil Graham, the guy that told everybody that they were just whiners when gas prices ran up over $4 a gallon. It was passed along, the act was passed along party lines in the Senate, received both Republican and Democrat support. Signed into law by a Democrat, President Bill Clinton. You know, I really have a desire sometimes to talk politics, but I will not. I will not do this because, you know, I don't want to make people upset, but I will point out facts as and when facts become an important element of what we need to know. And you need to know, ladies and gentlemen, that there was a bipartisan effort to repeal the one piece of legislation which made it impossible for some of these shenanigans to take place. By the way, with full approval and assent and encouragement of the then Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan. So what else can I possibly say? All right. Let's have a look at a little bit more mail that came in. Another rant from Steve. I think we should deal with that. We can't go without dealing with the rants today. Well, this one came in a little earlier from Steve Kruger. This is what he says. He sent this morning at 8:39 a.m. He said, "Richard, it looks like we could be set up for another Bear Stearns weekend. Bad things seem to happen on weekends. I have to wonder if Mr. Cyan thinks it's a good idea to buy his company's stock. If he is still buying it, he sure is getting a lot more shares for his buck. At $3.25 a share, the time to write the check that will never be written has arrived. Richard, the Chris Martinson crash course is excellent. Like yourself, he has a way to take a difficult subject and make it understandable. It is 2 hours well spent. Thanks for wake-up call, Steve Kruger." Well, thanks for the email, Steve. Lots of you have expressed a lot of satisfaction over this economics crash course by Chris Martinson that I mentioned last week, or I think perhaps on Monday, last week, I think. I do urge you to take the course. If you haven't taken it already, please do so, because I think clearly my speculation that it would be of interest and of use to you paid off. A lot of you have said you liked it, and so why not? 2 hours, when you have the odd 2 hours free, you could do a lot worse than bone up on Chris Martinson's crash course on economics. It is, as Steve says, excellent. Okay, John Fodera wrote in on Friday last, almost a week ago, and he says as follows: "While the United States may be in greater trouble than the markets realize, China may be in less. In other words, the slump in the West may not be so soft. In the East, it may not be in a slump at all. Retail sales in the United States are falling, but sales in China are going up at 23% a year. Even after inflation, they're going up at 15%, the fastest pace in 9 years. Sales of gasoline are increasing at a 55% annual rate. Incomes are rising too. Real after-inflation incomes are going up at an 8% annual rate. In other words, maybe China is not slowing down very much after all." Well, by the way, that came from Chuck Butler, president of Everbank World Markets, courtesy of John Fodera. I think Chuck is mistaken. The economy is definitely slowing in China. All the statistics say so. The stock market, not least of all, has fallen dramatically in recent weeks. People thought it was going to be held up because of the Olympics, but actually in the event, it was not. It has not been held up. It fell 3%, 3.5% last night, and it fell 4% the previous day. So, I mean, we're seeing a mini crash actually in China right now, or we had been. I'm afraid China is going to see great social unrest as the West simply finds itself unable and unwilling to buy the Chinese products. And when that happens, China will suffer immeasurably, because I don't think it knows how to deal with social unrest. It's the sort of thing that, quite frankly, is new to China. And this is new certainly in the degree to which China has been ramping up its economy to feed the West at very competitive prices. But I think people are not being made aware of this. I think people just think that, you know, China is the new kid on the block. It's going to do very well, which is true. But I don't think that people have really realized that just like the United States before it, there were booms, but then there were also busts. And the bust in China, I think, will be very dramatic and very grim. And there will be a lot of unrest. I think China's advantage, frankly, is that it is not a democracy. And so it can very much more quickly alleviate the problem through decrees, governmental decrees, which don't require politicians who need to be re-elected saying absurd things. So I think that the recovery might be quicker. But in the meantime, right now, we're looking at rolling down the hill into the abyss. And until we get into that abyss, I don't think we should be talking about, you know, the future of China being so rosy, because I think that will cause many injudicious investments to take place and stupid statements to get made. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is Thursday. Tomorrow is Friday, the weekend. I hope you all have a wonderful one, and I look forward to talking to you again on Monday at 1 p.m., usual time, same place. This is Richard Martin, Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, saying bye-bye till then.